The talk this evening is a little bit of an experiment, because on a retreat like this, I don't usually teach a sutta for an entire talk. And tonight, I'm teaching a sutta for the entire talk, because this is a sutta that speaks to me. I was kind of sorting through all these different, you know, there's a multitude of things that we can share about that may be alive in your experience, that are alive in our experience. And this sutta called the Atidanda Sutta just kept coming around. And the word danda means stick. Not like a little twig that you might find on one of the rocking trails, but a stick, like a rod. Atta means picking up. Danda means stick. So the name of the sutta is that of picking up a rod, picking up a stick. And I think part of why this sutta is so resonant for me, that's a word we keep using up here, isn't it? Resonant. Part of why this sutta is evocative for me is the way that the metaphors of the sutta ring true for me. The ways that my heart is touched by the imagery of the sutta, and because I really relate to the Buddha's words from my own journey of practice, and perhaps you may as well. So if Howie did Brilliant Sanity Part 2, this would be Four Noble Truths-ish Part 2 after Victoria's talk. So in a few minutes, I'll read the sutta to you in two parts, and then we'll unpack it together. This is from the Sutta Nipata, from the chapter of the eights, and this is one of the most diverse collections of discourses within the Pali Canon, within all of these different discourses. It's taken from a portion of the canon called the Atakavaga, and it's said that it may very well be the oldest portion of the Pali Canon. And, you know, this was an oral tradition for around 500 years before any of it came into writing. And that really touches me, that the teachings were kept alive by the beings who were in person around the Buddha. Can you imagine being in person around such a realized heart? The Buddha had a son. Can you imagine if your dad were the Buddha? I mean, he left, right? But you had a pretty cool dad. So there was the love and devotion that so many beings had for hundreds of years, memorizing the teachings because they were impacted by them, and from generation to generation, them being passed on as an oral tradition that carries the kind of the harmony, the vibrational quality that comes through the voice. And then they were written down, and they were probably written down by people who had more access to education and power at the time. And then they kept getting translated. So it can be a little bit like a game of telephone. And the heart of the teachings really rings true. The translation I'm sharing is from Andrew Olensky, who used to be part of Berry Center for Buddhist Studies, and I really appreciate the work of the translators. There's a way they're bringing to life the felt sense of teachings from 2,600 years ago, and that's important, you know, because language matters, words do matter. So I'll share this with you in a few minutes, and the poem is in the first person, and it's like a poem because each line has eight syllables. It's kind of beautiful. And the sutta reveals the personal process by which the Buddha came to some measure of understanding. He's speaking to his vulnerability in particular. And he's speaking to the sense of fear and dread that arises as he sees more deeply the nature of the human condition. So So again, this is not life is suffering, like Victoria said. Like Victoria, she said, life is. We know what she said. She said, as an example, the truth is not that life is suffering. The truth is that there is suffering, and there is a way through suffering, which is why we're here. And so in this passage, he's speaking to the fear and the dread, and he's illuminating his way through. So the first half is describing basically the predicament we find ourselves in. I'll read you the first half, and I want you to pay attention to what happens in your bodies. Pay attention to the impact of the sutta on your citta. Fear is born from arming oneself. Just see how many people fight. I'll tell you about the dreadful fear that caused me to shake all over. Seeing creatures flopping around like fish in water too shallow, so hostile to one another. Seeing this, I became afraid. This world completely lacks essence. It trembles in all directions. I longed to find myself a place unscathed, but I could not see it. Seeing people locked in conflict, I became completely distraught. But then I discerned here a thorn, hard to see, lodged deep in the heart. It's only when pierced by this thorn that one runs in all directions. So if that thorn is taken out, one does not run and settles down. I'm curious to hear from a few of you, just popcorn style, a word or two about what happens for you as you take in these words, these ancient words. What do you notice? Constricting?
Release.
Release?
Trembling.
Trembling.
Dullness in the chest area.
Sadness. Say again. Gaza, yeah. Yeah. Every time I kind of contemplate the sutta, like I feel something in my body. Not always the same. But these are powerful images. Shaking, fish, in water, trembling, lacking essence, a thorn, running and settling down. So this first stanza, I'm going to read it again and then talk about it with you. Fear is born from arming oneself. It's a strong statement. The sutta begins with an observation. Fear is born from arming oneself. Just see how many people fight. I'll tell you about the dreadful fear that caused me to shake all over. So perhaps these images relate to some measure of what we know as our present-day reality. And it's interesting, the observation that fear is born from arming oneself. That's different than fear subsides by arming oneself. Fear is born. And so some of what may be suggested here is what we think will protect us may actually bring more tension. And I'm talking about this. I'm not actually speaking politically. I'm saying, you know, like what actually happens in the experience of taking up arms. And this could be literal, like the name of the sutta, Atadanda, picking up a rod. There's a sense that this response contributes to the layering of fear upon fear upon fear. And he's making another observation. Just see how many people fight. He's seeing it. You know, and in this, in these words, he's letting us know he's affected. He's letting us know he's impacted. He's relating what is agitating in him. He's relating his experience of the citta, the fear and the shaking. And he's talking about body and mind. I love that he talks about the body here. We could also consider perhaps a less literal way of understanding what he's pointing to. There's the literal taking up an arm. And do you know the experience in the process of meditation, how it might be to be defending against something in your experience or some part of yourself? Because we can do it internally too. Like the war wages on, not just externally, but internally, which is part of what gives rise to what we know externally. So just the sense is, what is this process of internally defending against or taking up arms against ourselves, so to speak? And do you armor or brace with regard to no sleepiness, please? Or I'm really angry. I'm not going to be angry. I'm going to be a good meditator. I'm really angry. Nope. Is there a sense of, oh, I know there's this huge well of grief, and I'm not going down that road, not here. Later, not enough time. Part of how I experience that in my own experience is the places where my practice gets quiet and I can feel this just slight tendency to hold back. It's a very subtle kind of holding back, but it's persistent. It comes from the patterning in my mother's family. I know it well. Just this kind of slight bracing, slight holding back. From what? Maybe from that which is unfamiliar. Maybe from just the raw vulnerability of a soft belly. You know, the practice, being in the present moment, invites us again and again and again to, as we've all been speaking about, coming into don't know mind, which can sound really like esoteric and cool, but in reality, it takes a lot of trust. Insight doesn't come from a conceptual mind that has it all figured out. Insight arises from all the conditions being in place. It's just like a strike of lightning. It's this natural, organic process. It's not prefabricated. We can want it, but we can't plan it. So just to be noticing, if you feel kind of like bracing against, defending against, get really curious. What is happening there? Like open to it. Because in a defense, on some level, we're protecting something precious. We're protecting our hearts. And what actually protects us isn't the tension for the most part. It's knowing the nature of our hearts. Like on one level, our hearts break. We know how it is for the heart to break open. On another level, our hearts never break because they've always been whole. So he's naming the problem of people hurting each other. He's affected. And we know that there's times where we do feel kind of a shake, whether it's a literal shake in the body or just like a trembling inside. Like, what is this? Awareness can hold that. We allow. It's entirely, entirely natural. And there can be just this sense in the practice, especially as things settle, there can be just, oh, am I okay? Am I okay? Do you know that feeling? Just the kind of checking it out. Am I okay? Am I okay? Am I okay? And so like our most vulnerable dimensions are wanting to know that we're safe enough. Am I okay? Second stanza. Seeing creatures flopping around like fish in water too shallow, so hostile to one another. Seeing this, I became afraid. It's another strong image, isn't it? You know, perhaps he's afraid in part because there's a sense of helplessness. Becoming afraid, he's not yet saying, oh, I know how to handle this. He's just seeing the dukkha, right? But he's seeing it. He's seeing dukkha, kind of the raw dukkha of experience. He's seeing sankhara dukkha, the dukkha that just comes from being embodied in a certain way. And there can be a feeling of kind of confusion, of flopping around when we see the suffering and we don't know the path. That's its own suffering. That was part of what brought me as a young woman to learn to meditate. Like I needed a technology and an art of how experientially to really meet all the tangles, all the knots in myself. And he comes back to this hostility to one another, you know, fighting for some sense of agency, some sense of control, which is different than path activity. You know, path activity, what we're practicing here is onward leading. It makes room for something other than our history. It makes room for something other than our programming. Path activity begins to make our programming become less opaque, lighter, bit by bit more translucent. And I think he's speaking to just kind of a fundamental, you know, so often we think something's wrong if we feel anxiety. Nobody likes to feel anxiety, and it's so deeply human. It's so deeply human and part of a spiritual path. You know, in many ways, when anxiety rises up, there can be a sense of, oh, I'm on the edge of something new. I'm in a place that I haven't been before. So this is like, this is the Buddha before he became a Buddha. This is the Buddha going through feelings not unlike our own. You know, his nervous system, human nervous system, just like all the nervous systems sitting in this room, mine and yours. The third stanza here. The world completely lacks essence. It trembles in all directions. I longed to find myself a place unscathed, but I could not see it. Do you know that longing? Yearning. Deep yearning. That's a yearning to be free from suffering. And that yearning to find a place unscathed, but there's nowhere to go outside of our own hearts, right? Where do you go? You think it's going to change dramatically when you leave the retreat? You're still in your own heart. You can't abandon your own citta. You know, like, we don't have the conditions. That it doesn't exist to find some heavenly realm where we're totally free and free from the kinds of things that Buddha's pointing to here. We can develop the wisdom where we're not bound by this stuff, but there's no, like, you know, like there's wildlife refuges. There's no, like, human suffering refuge. There's Buddha Dhamma Sangha. But it's not like you could just, I mean, maybe you go to the spa for a while, but you're still with you. You know, maybe you take a walk for a while. You're still with you. Good chocolate, you're still with you. It always ends. So he's seeing the unreliability of experience, this pointing toward seeing the lack of essence. And maybe this happened for you during COVID. Like, so much of what we maybe took to be assumed or the way things were, like, it all changed, right? So much changed. Or if you've lost someone you loved suddenly, you might know the experience of the sense of, like, the illusions of permanence just being blown open. You know, blown apart. And our delusions of permanence are functional. Like, I don't want to wake up thinking my beloved is not going to be here tomorrow. I don't want to think about that all the time. Like, it wouldn't be helpful. But deep down, you know, it's anything can happen at any time. This is the world that we live in. So he's seeing the unreliability of experience. And in the seeing of this, there is a measure of suffering that he's bearing, that he's enduring, that he's standing under, that's in service to the end of suffering. Like, when life is going along rainbows and unicorns, most people aren't drawn to deep path activity. Like, it's usually some kind of dukkha that brings us to path activity. If you already have path activity and your life is going great, hopefully the practice just continues along. But, like, it takes a squeeze for most of us to do something like this. And so as we practice, we do begin to see anicca. We begin to see inconstancy, not just constancy. Not just, oh, I'm Aaron, this is who I am. Got it. The inconstancy. You know, the Aaron that's here right now is a little bit different than the Aaron who was here this morning or who's going to be here tomorrow morning. Or, you know, are you the same you with every person you're around? We're much more fluid than fixed. So when he's seeing the world completely lacks essence, there's a sense that the safety blanket of the conceptual mind doesn't apply. And it doesn't soothe. And in this place of seeing insubstantiality, which in a period of meditation, it's like even what we say breath, in breath, out breath, like even that becomes kind of coarse, right? So much happens in in breath. So much happens in out breath if we're interested. Glimmering, luminous, flickering. Mingling. It's not a thing. And the more we see this, the more that clinging makes less and less sense. Not to the coconut, but less and less sense really deep down. And there's a movement in the direction of what we call disenchantment. You might know how it is to feel kind of enchanted under the spell of, oh, the next house, the different body, the most beautiful scarf, the right meditation retreat, the right teacher, the right partner. You know, just we get enchanted, you know? And the dominant culture feeds this massively. And it's part of what impedes a deeper maturational process in our lives and communities and spiritually. You know, we are trained to be enchanted, but that's like a fairy tale. That's like being within the spell. You know, the feeling of a spell, right? Like, all kind of intoxicating in a certain way. Disenchantment kind of loses the fascination with the state of being in a spell. You know, when the Buddha sees that the world is lacking essence, if the world is lacking essence and we're seeing it, enduring satisfaction isn't going to live in the senses being gratified in the world. It's not permanent. It doesn't last. And so the process of disenchantment is like a crack in our worldview. The spell begins to break. When the perception is not perceiving and seeing what it expects to see. And this is inevitable as things roll along. And, you know, sometimes this can actually feel kind of ungrounding because we're seeing dissolving more than form. It can feel a bit scary. And there can even be what we call nostalgia for samsara. I remember feeling this in my late 20s. Can I please be cheap and superficial? Can I please not keep finding myself in these dang retreats? Can I please get more interested in the cocktail parties? You know? Like a nostalgia for the delusion of samsara exists for a reason, I think. Like when we don't see clearly, it looks satisfying. You know, like the Buddha's life in the palace was probably satisfying to a certain measure, but not deeply because he left. And we're here today. So basically this seeing the world lacking essence and longing to find a place free from the trembling. This is what Victoria was pointing to. The suffering is to be understood. He's talking about suffering. Craving is to be abandoned. And as we see more and more clearly, we're seeing really the empty nature of things, to be direct. We stop craving them in the same way. We just don't get the same hit of gratification, the same hit of pleasure, and it's often experienced as it can be a little bit of a loss, actually. And then as time goes on, there's just a settling. The momentum of the craving really settles down. There's a quality of dispassion that remains. And this desire, I long to find myself a place unscathed, but I could not see it. It's a kind of, sometimes we experience this as a really deep, deep longing for deliverance, a desire for deliverance, a desire to not be bound up in these cycles of craving, in these cycles of mistaken identity, in these cycles of becoming. Just a gut level desire for deliverance. And there's some clear seeing about the human predicament to even have that longing touch us so deeply. The fourth stanza, seeing people locked in conflict, I became completely distraught. But then I discerned here a thorn, hard to see lodged deep in the heart. That's a real image. A thorn in the heart. And I kind of like that image because in a sense, it's like the thorn, which I'll say some things about, represents our confusion, our patterns of becoming, our greed, hatred, delusion. And the image of a thorn in the heart is like, oh, maybe that's not native to the heart. It's like something got put in the heart. Maybe that's like something, almost like the patterning of our cultures, our families, the systems of freedom and oppression that are at work in our lives. Like, oh, what comprises the thorn is multifaceted. But, you know, the image of a thorn in the heart is like, is a baby born with a thorn in their heart? So he's saying, I became distraught as I'm seeing the conflict. I became distraught. And, you know the experience of being distraught. It's hard to even think clearly. Distraught, this experience of being distraught kind of floods us out. It kind of takes us over. But this is an aha moment for the Buddha. This is a big aha. I discerned here a thorn. Like, he's beginning to touch. This isn't how he's talking about the Buddha didn't have gurus when it came to his full awakening. He had teachers around concentration and stuff, but he didn't have somebody map out for him what he's mapped out for us. You know, he's saying, I discerned here a thorn. So he's beginning to zero in on where the suffering comes from. So the thorn is just a metaphor, yeah, for the patterns that grip us, keep us unsettled, all the patterns of becoming. And I wanted to share with you a passage by Carl Jung that I love with regard to the thorn. I feel very strongly that I'm under the influence of things or questions which were left incomplete and unanswered by my parents and grandparents and more distant ancestors. It often seems as if there were an impersonal karma within a family, which is passed on from parents to children. It's always seemed to me that I had to complete or perhaps continue this which previous ages had left unfinished. You ever feel that? I do. It's like the thorn has a unique shape and texture for each of us. And if you think about an actual wound, you don't just pull something out. You don't just pull something out because doing that can make something get more lodged. It can make the wound go in deeper. Because the body shapes itself around the foreign object, around the thorn. And so, you know, it's like pulling out a thorn or a sliver is with so much care, so much. If you've pulled out slivers, it's like so much attention. And really, it's like the sati, the mindfulness, the samadhi, the collectedness, the metta, the loving kindness, the panya, the wisdom. This is how we pull out a thorn in a way that doesn't cause more injury. Because as human beings, we do experience wounds to our heart, wounds to our being. It's like that's so beautiful that the practice, it softens the tissues of who we are in a sense that, oh, the thorn begins to fall out on its own. There's just not room for it. I'm going to share a poem with you. This is a story about a boy having his dad pull out a sliver, and then the poet, and then you'll hear the voice of him when he's older. I'm sharing this with you because of the energy and the care and kind of the attention, really the heart qualities. This is by Lee Young Lee, called "The Gift to Pull the Metal Splinter from My Palm." My father recited a story in a low voice. I watched his lovely face and not the blade. Before the story ended, he'd removed the iron sliver I thought I'd die from. I can't remember the tale, but hear his voice still, a well of dark water, a prayer. And I recall his hands, two measures of tenderness he laid against my face. Also, the flames of discipline he raised above my head. Had you entered that afternoon, you would have thought you saw a man, planting something in a boy's palm. A silver tear, a tiny flame. Had you followed that boy, you would have arrived here where I bend over my wife's right hand. Look how I shave her thumbnail down so carefully she feels no pain. Watch as I lift the splinter out. I was 7 when my father took my hand like this, and I did not hold that shard between my fingers and think, metal that will bury me, ore going deep for my heart. And I did not lift up my wound and cry, death visited here. I did what a child does when he's given something to keep. I kissed my father. I love this. I also love this because often you don't hear so much between fathers and sons with that kind of a tone. And it's so beautiful. So tender. Of taking out the thorn, and when you're locked in, you know, in frustration or kind of bracing against your own patterning, just like, remember, this is the nature of the patterning. This is the nature of the thorn. It's conditioned. Conditions are such, this arises. Conditions are not such, this does not arise. The process of meditation impacts the stream of the conditioning quite profoundly. Fifth stanza. It's only when pierced by this thorn that one runs in all directions. So if that thorn is taken out, one does not run and settles down. So there's a pointing here to the possibility of peace. There's a pointing here to the settling down, not just as a passing state, but the deep settling down of that, am I okay, am I okay? A deep settling down of the feeling of being buffeted about by patterning and not knowing what to do with it. And this happens through practice. This happens as we understand the nature of dukkha. You know, we become released bit by bit from the depth of the agitation and the depth of the dissatisfaction. But paradoxically, it's through the dissatisfaction and the agitation that that's possible. Like, the only way out really is through. Otherwise, it's a big, fat spiritual bypass, and it doesn't really make you more happy. And it takes so much kindness to work with these patterns in this way. It takes so much kindness. I think of when I did body work, really working with tissues and history and so much. And you know, like when somebody will come in super braced, it didn't work to push through things. You know, it really never worked. It took gentleness, trust, softening, allowing, you know, for the tissues to open and let go on their own. And so there's a measure of pain in being aware of suffering and not feeling any transformation, and turning toward it and knowing how is such an incredible gift. And it can feel like, oh, there's this risk of engaging, right? What's going to happen? What's going to happen if I truly investigate the story of I'm not good enough? What's going to happen? And then there's a risk of not engaging. Because if we don't engage, things are probably going to continue the way they have been. And then there's the risks, yeah, of just talking yourself into disidentifying, but that's not really disidentifying, you know? The second part of the sutta is pointing to how to cultivate, to use the translator's words, how to cultivate a state of mind that avoids the dysfunctional move of creating and projecting oneself onto every situation. Wouldn't that be a relief? Oh, feels so good, right? Feels so good. And if you hang out with people, that's like if you hang out with people who don't do so much of that, where that projecting just doesn't happen, it's so beautiful. It's so free. We feel ourselves in a certain way. It's contagious, in fact. I'm just going to go through this briefly, and I'm going to read stanza by stanza. This is the third noble truth. This is cessation. This is to be realized. And I'm doing a bit of a literary thing because I think they use certain words. This is view and opinion. I'm so not a scholar in this territory, but I think to have 8 syllables, they maybe use certain words in the translation. And I'm gonna substitute the word suffer for the word grieve, because it's my hunch at that point that the way we use grief in kind of common psychological language, that they're actually pointing to something a little bit different, having to do with suffering. So the second part of the sutta, who here has crossed over desires, the world's bond, so hard to get past? She does not suffer. He does not mourn. Their stream is cut. She's all unbound. And this is the metaphor of the floods, just the metaphor of being in the world but knowing something more. Being in the world but not bound by the world. And I want to just, unbound is a powerful word too. The felt sense of being bound means we are not free. We are not liberated. We are not in charge of our own, of what happens to our own bodies in a certain way, unbound. And in the practice, there's moments where you can almost feel the energy of unbinding. It's a particular flavor of release that's very beautiful. And as the path unfolds, there's an unfolding called emancipation. That's another strong word. Emancipation, vimutti. It's like things become unbound. That which was stuck becomes free. We can move. We can move freely. It's a real kind of freedom. And what I'm talking about, it's not theoretical. This happens, and this happens here. This happens here. This happens with people in our Sangha. It's very, very beautiful over time. The freeing, the unbinding. So it frees up something else, right? When something stops happening, what remains? What went before, this next stanza is an instruction to us. It's like a practice instruction. What went before, let go of all that. All that's to come, have none of it. Don't hold on to what's in between, and you'll wander fully at peace. So this is just what we've been talking about. Self needs past and future. And we need a self to suffer. This feeds the grasping and rejecting. So all that went before, let go of that. He goes on, for whom there is no I-making, all throughout,
the body and mind, and who suffers not for what is not, is undefeated in the world. So this is a way of a kind of a spiritual victory is what they're pointing to, so to speak. And it has to do with the lacking essence. We don't get to have just everything out there lack essence, but then have me not lack essence. Lacking essence. Empty nature. So this is a settling of the process of becoming of me making and my making. Barry Magid puts it like this, which links it back to the heart. That when self-centeredness comes to an end, we discover that our self has ceased to exist. We discover not that our self has ceased to exist, but that the self is not what we thought. The self is no longer an inner sanctum of private experience or a narrow set of personal needs or expectations. Our world is ourself, rather than ourself being our world. You feel that difference? Our world is ourself. That's what Thich Nhat Hanh was speaking to when he talked about the next Buddha being Sangha. Our world is ourself, rather than ourself being our world. So I love that. And the last stanza of the sutta, for whom there is no this is mine, nor anything like that is theirs, not even finding selfness, she does not grieve, she does not suffer it, I have nothing. Let me read that one more time. It's okay if this doesn't make great sense. For whom there is no this is mine, nor anything like that is theirs, not even finding selfness, she does not suffer at I have nothing. Whoa. To not suffer at I have nothing, because if we have nothing, we have everything. This is really pointing to the end of the cycle of becoming. It's not a nihilistic teaching. That's not what's being pointed to, but the end of the cycle of becoming. And so when we see, you know, the suffering, the way through, it is ours to navigate, and ultimately it's not personal, and it is ours to navigate. This is the human condition. And, you know, just in sitting with this today before coming in to teach, it's like compassion really is all that makes sense. What else are we going to do? Just get tighter and tighter? You know, compassion is what makes sense. Compassion is what takes out the thorn. Carl Sagan, he says it like this, in all our searching, the only thing we found that makes the emptiness bearable is each other. Is each other. So we become compassioned. It's not just a kind of intellectual understanding of the noble truths. Or if there is a not just an intellectual, but an experiential insight understanding of the noble truths of suffering and its cause and the way through and how to live in a way that is good for us and good for others. It is, you know, compassion is how that realization is manifest. You know, one who has taken the journey that is shared in the sutta, which is really a personal sharing from the Buddha about his own vulnerability and his own journey of freedom. Tremendous compassion and devotion to the practice is the only sanity I know of. lot of words, huh? What do you notice now in your experience? Say again.
Humbled.
Yeah.
Open.
Open. Say again back there.
Hope.
Hope.
Gratitude.
Light.
Spacious.
Spacious. I just have a feeling of gratitude for kind of the mercy of this understanding. There is so much mercy in this practice and in this understanding and, you know, in these ancient words that are as true today as they were so long ago. So my intention tonight is just kind of like sharing some of the context, kind of the deeper context of why we're doing what we're doing and why it really matters. Yeah, why it really matters. Let's just take a few moments of silence together, quiet together. Thank you for your kind attention. I'll see you back for walking. Or for sitting. Go walk. We'll see you back for sitting.